Of all my books, Ballad in Blue is the worst selling, although it's not as though it doesn't have some stiff competition. This is the story of Ballad in Blue. A few years ago, living in Tallinn, I decided to take a break from the non-stop bloodfest of crime writing and write an esoteric romantic drama set in Estonia. I used to get a haircut in a place where all the barbers were young women dressed in black. It was like getting your hair cut by Robert Palmer's backing band. My idea was to write a story about one of the barbers who would happily sleep her way through several customers a week before falling in love with a Syrian immigrant. There are very, very few Syrian immigrants in the Baltics. The story would be told in the first person by a young chap, Joel, after the fashion of Nick Carraway and Gatsby, who would sleep with her, fall in love, and then watch her work her way through every other customer in the shop. The story didn't pan out that way, and soon enough it was obvious it was going to be about Joel rather than the barber. I wrote a draft of around 300 pages, then decided I'd rewrite it as a film script, just to get a different perspective from the story to see what other ideas I could come up with. I obviously felt I had time on my hands, although this is, in fact, a very good idea for making any writer look at their story from a different perspective. Where I worked in my flat, I looked down over the Chinese ambassador's garden, and in the autumn, when I was writing, there would regularly be a gardener using a leaf blower, and I'd sit and curse them in their bloody racket. Then the phrase, "the leaf blower in the Chinese ambassador's garden," came into my head, and I thought it sounded like a good book title. So that's what I originally went with, although I changed the nationality of the ambassador. The leaf blower in the Japanese ambassador's garden. The film script idea was really just part of the process, and I had no intention of it ever actually being a film. It still isn't actually a film. That's not where this next part of the tale goes. Then one evening, my wife, the diplomat, was at a cocktail party to mark the launch of the Tallinn Black Nights Film Festival, and she got talking to an Estonian film producer named Ivo Felt. There used to be a time when she thought I should go to cocktail parties, and I'd go to the cocktail party and stand in a corner not talking to anyone. And if my mood was ill enough, I would look particularly miserable and a 10-yard exclusion zone of cantankerousness would form around me. And then my wife would say, "You really oughtn't to come to cocktail parties," or words to that effect. So that evening at that particular cocktail party, my wife says to Ivo, "What do you do?" And he says something along the lines of, "I'm a film producer. My last movie, Tangerines, was nominated in the foreign language categories at the Oscars and Golden Globes. So I attended this year's Oscar ceremony as a nominee. I'm an Oscar-nominated film producer. What do you do?" And my wife says, "Never mind about me. My husband's writing a film script set in Tallinn. Would you like to read it?" And Ivo says, "Why, I'd love to." And she comes home and says, "By the way, that film script you're casually writing as an exercise with no intention of ever showing it to anyone is now going to be put in front of an Oscar-nominated movie producer. So you better go on with it." I met Ivo a couple of times. He's a lovely chap, but I don't think he liked my script. I certainly never heard from him again after he read it, if he read it. And to be fair, his movies are fairly heavy, serious studies of Estonians under pressure, at least those that I've seen are. The leaf blower in the Japanese ambassador's garden would have been way too frivolous for him, although he never got back to me to say. Not speaking when you don't have to is pretty much the definition of being Estonian. Anyway, at some stage I decided that I'd spent too much time on it, and it was time I got on with writing crime novels again, so I put the book and script away in a metaphorical drawer and spent the next year writing various crime novels in various series. Then a while later, when the stock of crime novels had been replenished, I decided to go back to my esoteric romance. By then, however, our departure from Tallinn was imminent, and in the meantime I'd visited Washington DC a couple of times, loved Georgetown, and decided to set the book there instead. I also made the decision to completely scrap the first draft, and to write it as a third-person story based around the film script. And I changed the title to Ballad in Blue, after the Hoagy Carmichael song, which is on the Hoagy LP, Hoagy Sings Carmichael with the Pacific Jasmine, which is Joel's favourite album, and also my favourite album, which avid readers might recognise as the LP that plays as the killer Durant slaughters 9 people while butt-naked with a massive erection in We Are the Hanged Man. As I started to write the book, I realised I was literally translating a film script, as though the reader was watching a film, and I was about to go back and start again when I thought, damn it, I'm just going to write this in the first person plural, present tense, as though we, the readers, are watching the movie at the cinema. And that's how it stayed. Writing it that way, it ended up pretty short. The original draft had long, rambling conversations, but they were all butchered to the book's benefit in the original conversion to film script, as well as switching the location. At some stage along the way, the barbershop became an old music shop, and the story became about the relationship between Joel and his lesbian aunt. When it was ready, I ran it past my agent and my editor at Hodder, just in case one of them swooned. They both called it excellent, but literary and too short, and that no one would buy it. Potentially, of course, they just both hated it. It's not like there aren't short literary novels out there in abundance. I've read some of them. I know they exist. While it remains open to question whether they were right about the book's excellence, they were bang on about no one buying it. Here's a short excerpt from Ballad in Blue. It's the following morning. Unusually, it seems that Joel is up early, despite having the day off. Even when he works, his day never begins before midday, and Joel rarely gets up before 10. Yet here he is, walking down the hill into Georgetown between 8:30 and 9. It's possible that Joe has a meeting or at least an assignment of some sort, a something to do. But deep down we know, Joel rarely has anything to do beyond his work. Likely he's been unable to sleep, and after the few restless hours in bed, will have risen with the dawn. It's a warm morning, but fresher than of late. Again, Joel has an air about him. Could be mistaken for languor by the casual observer, but we know Joel well enough already to recognise his innate melancholia. Perhaps now we're beginning to feel a little concern for him. Yet his melancholy fits him well. Like a glove, a poet might have said. Even the poet Bob Dylan used the phrase, fits me like a glove. So why shouldn't we use it to describe the sadness that hangs over Joel? Back to Wisconsin, although several blocks from where we saw him the previous day, Joel waits at the lights. The green sign summons him over the road. He walks slowly across, then turns up the first side street he comes to, and enters a cafe just around the corner. The cafe has a grey clapperboard frontage, with the simple sign, the coffee bean, above the door. There are huge windows on either side with white painted frames. The front of the cafe is not adorned with anything to try to lure in customers. It doesn't need to be. The coffee bean sells coffee and food on its reputation alone, and its reputation is very good. We follow Joel inside. The cafe stretches further back than we thought, so there are in all 20 tables. Most of them are occupied. It's a very popular place, but there are a couple of empty two-seat tables. Joel selects the one closest to the window and takes a seat. Usually he would have a newspaper or an iPad with him, something to keep him distracted. Today we can tell that Joel will be happy to sit alone with his coffee, watching the world. With 18 other occupied tables, one might suppose there would be a lively buzz around the place. However, 10 of the tables have single occupants, all of whom are looking at either laptops or phones, and there are 3 further tables with multiple occupants, all of whom are too occupied with devices to speak to each other. This leaves 5 tables where conversations are taking place. It is before 9 in the morning, and all the chatter is subdued. Joel can sit where he is, at the heart of it all, and not be forced to listen to any of it, which suits him perfectly. The clientele averages out at around Joel's age. He is amongst his people. The music playing is Count Basie, but it's turned down low. Joel is staring idly out the window, watching people in the street. Good morning. Would you like some coffee? Joel turns. He doesn't recognise the waitress, which is unusual. He knows all the waitresses and all their names. She's in her mid-20s, is wearing the regulation long black skirt in the black blouse of the house, and is holding the regulation coffee jug steaming and half-filled. I'll have the Colombian roast, please, says Joel. Jug of hot milk. Sure. Large or small? Large and a glass of water. From the tap's fine. Sure. Can I get you something to eat? I'm good, says Joel. Our special today is chocolate croissant. It's delicious. Her smile and enthusiasm for selling the product is infectious. This place always has chocolate croissant, says Joel, like every morning. Today they're particularly tasty, says the waitress, still smiling, and Joel can't help smiling back. Sure, he says, that sounds nice. I'll have a chocolate croissant. Good choice. I'm Mia, I'm new. I'll be your waitress today. Joel, says Joel. Nice to meet you, Joel. You all right? You look kind of sad. Well, that's hardly great insight from Mia, because she's right after all. Joel does look kind of sad. Still, unusual for a waitress who's known him for under a minute to express that. I'm fine, thanks, says Joel, giving the default answer. Okie dokie, says Mia, already starting to turn away. You know where to find me. Large Colombian roast with hot milk. Chocolate croissant coming right up. A short time later, Joel has started his coffee, but the large mug is still mostly intact. Perhaps, for all we know, this is a refill. The chocolate croissant is half eaten, but we don't know if Joel's given up on it or whether we've come across him mid-bite. Most of the seats around him are the same occupants. But then the Coffee Bean is the kind of place where a man or woman will come, open up their MacBook, and still be in the same spot 2 hours later, having drunk 2 cups of house coffee. Wonder what Joel's thinking about. It's time to find out. We hear a child's voice off-screen as the child is neither in the cafe nor standing outside. The child is Joel himself, in what is obviously a significant moment from his past. This kind of flashback is the sort of thing that people seem to think about in movies, but perhaps would never actually think in real life. This particular flashback turns out to be in 3 parts. The first part is not especially a moment that Joel thinks about often, but the moment it leads up to is an occasion he remembers well. The evening that followed was of less significance than the afternoon, but Joel remembers it for something he said that in retrospect feels foolish. Fortunately, he said the foolish thing to his parents, and they were unlikely to ever mention it to anyone. "But Mum!" Child's voice, off-screen, cries. Joel stares blankly out of the window. The child Joel is a few years older than the last time we saw him, which we recall was when he was watching Aunt Jane pack her case, preparing for an adventure in the Burmese jungle. Now Joel is dressed in a smart white shirt, buttoned at the collar and long black trousers. Mrs. Black is fussing at his neck with a bow tie, and the 12-year-old Joel, bored and restless, is not helping. "Will you stand still, for goodness sake?" says Mrs. Black. "When will Aunt Jane get here? She'll be here when you're dressed properly." "Mum!" Joel does not stand still, and those of us in the audience who have ever had to get a child dressed know full well the difficulty of Mrs. Black's situation. While she's perhaps a periphery figure with whom we have little in common, she certainly has our sympathy at this point. Finally, she manages to get the tie fixed. She straightens it and then steps back, nodding. "It'll do," she says. "Try and keep it straight, please." "Is Aunt Jane here now?" asks Joel with a child's logic, although he's old enough that there's a note of cynicism in the question. "We're meeting Jane at the church." "Oh." We don't find the 12-year-old Joel quite as attractive as the 29-year-old version. "And just so you know, she's got someone with her." "Who?" Joel is instantly suspicious. Aunt Jane never has anyone with her. Joel doesn't want Jane to have anyone with her. "It's just a friend," says Mrs. Black. "People take boyfriends to weddings, don't they? Has Aunt Jane got a boyfriend?" "She's just a friend," says Mrs. Black. Joel looks curiously at his mother. It's good news that Aunt Jane doesn't have a boyfriend, but there was something in her tone. Joel just isn't sure what it meant. The door to the bedroom opens, and Mr. Black looks in without actually crossing the threshold. He's wearing a dark suit, white shirt and a blue tie. He would not be dressed so differently were he going to a funeral. Indeed, we will note he does in fact later on wear the same suit to Aunt Jane's funeral. He gives Joel the once-over and then says, "You're ready?" to Mrs. Black, in a tone that wonders whether or not she's yet to get changed. Mrs. Black nods, chooses to ignore the tone, as she always does, and taps Joel on the shoulder. "Come on, and no talking." Mr. Black turns away, leaving the door open, Mrs. Black and Joel following him out. We switch to a warm spring early afternoon outside a church. We don't know who it is getting married. That detail, so important to the two people concerned, is of no importance to us. There's a wedding and it has brought Aunt Jane back to the country. That's all that matters. We come to the church just as the Black family car pulls into the car park. Bells are ringing. There's a small crowd standing outside the church. Obviously the bride has not yet arrived and some of the guests have chosen to stand outside enjoying the sun. The Blacks get out of the car and look towards the crowd. We get the sense that, true to form, Mr. Black does not really want to be here. We suspect that if we follow the wedding through to its natural conclusion, we'd see Mrs. Black cry. "Is Aunt Jane here yet?" "Probably not," says Mr. Black. We know that Mr. Black has no idea whether or not Aunt Jane will be here or not, but a family wedding brings out the misanthrope in him. He will have an ill word for all. "Will she be wearing a hat?" "Goodness, how will we know that? Aunt Jane!" Joel spots Jane through the crowd and takes off across the car park. This isn't one of those dramatic moments, though. Joel is not suddenly about to be struck by a car. Even if he was, we'd know he'd be fine, so dramatically there'd be little point. "Joel!" shouts Mrs. Black, who's unaware that she doesn't need to worry about Joel being struck by a car. "Has to find out sometime," says Mr. Black. Mr. Black does not think Joel is about to be struck by a car. Mr. Black is referring to what Joel is about to learn about Aunt Jane. Joel runs into the crowd Aunt Jane sees him coming in waves. We see, before Joe notices, that Jane is with someone, a younger woman, perhaps only 17 or 18, with whom Jane is holding hands. Joel approaches, then comes to a juddering stop in front of him, seeing that Aunt Jane is not alone. "Jesus," says Joel. He stares, wide-eyed. They smile back at him. Aunt Jane is amused by his reaction. As she walks forward, she lets go of her partner's hand. "Joel," says Aunt Jane, "lovely to see you." She gives him a big hug. Joel looks wide-eyed over her shoulder at her partner. Jane lets him go, straightening up, and says, "This is my friend Beth. Beth, Joel." Beth extends her hand towards him. Joel is still dumbfounded, completely enthralled by her. It's not just that Aunt Jane appears to have a girlfriend. Beth, we have to agree, is beautiful. No surprise then that Joel is awestruck. "Wow," he says, when he finally manages to find a word. "You can shake my hand?" asks Beth, amused, her hand still outstretched. Joel shakes her hand and then is unable to let go. Beth smiles again and then straightens up, detaching from Joel as Mr. and Mrs. Black approach. There's a moment of stiffness as Mr. Black regards his sister. "Jane," he says. "Martin." Mrs. Black moves forward to kiss Jane on either cheek. And now we're into the awkward introductions as Aunt Jane, hitting 30 soon enough, as Mr. Black likes to point out, introduces her 17-year-old girlfriend. Joel stares at Beth throughout. As the awkwardness extends into a second minute, we see Beth glance at Joel and wink. Joel blushes and finally looks away. Some hours later, the wedding has taken place. We've had the meal and the speeches and whatever else has gone into the day. Perhaps there were fireworks. Perhaps there was an excruciating performance of "My Heart Will Go On" by a family friend in the church. We'll never know. We're at the part of the wedding where everyone can finally relax. There's nothing left but chatting and drinking and dancing and sitting alone at a table waiting for whoever it is you came with to decide to leave. There's a live band whose song selection is a little on the bland side for most people, but it's what the bride requested. "All love songs," he said. "All ballads. I want people to feel our love," she'd said, as part of the discussion. The band had been unhappy. Indeed, three of the five members had initially refused when the frontman had told them the brief. However, money talks, and there was a lot of money in the extended Black family. The band got paid, and the guests were being treated to an evening of "You're beautiful, and I will always love you, everything I do, and love is all around." The band's one planned act of rebellion, a full-on rocked-out Layla, was thwarted when word got out to the bride and she threatened to withhold payment. Layla had been replaced by Clapton's later song to Patti Boyd, "Wonderful Tonight." Joel is sitting at a table with Mr. and Mrs. Black. The table seats 8. It is unclear who else was sitting with them, as the other 5 seats are now empty. It is also unclear why the Blacks have not already upped and gone. We are left to assume that Mr. Black has enough of a connection with the wedding couple he feels he cannot yet leave. Mr. and Mrs. Black are sitting in sullen silence. Mr. Black is staring at the table. Mrs. Black is looking around the room, not actively recording who's talking to whom, but taking it all in nevertheless. She is not, however, looking at the dance floor. Joel is looking at the dance floor. There are several couples on there, but he only has eyes for one. As the band plays "At My Most Beautiful," Aunt Jane and Beth are in the midst of the crowd. Jane's arms around Beth's waist. Beth's arms hooked around Jane's neck. "Stop staring, Joel, really," says Mrs. Black, risking a quick glance at her sister-in-law. "It's intolerable," says Mr. Black. "She's young enough to be..." I'm not even going to say it. He grumbles. Mr. Black cannot bring himself to look at them. Joel, despite his mother's words, has not looked away. Aunt Jane and Beth are staring at each other. They kiss. A short kiss. They don't engage fully beneath the glare of the wedding reception spotlight. But it's sweet. Eyes closed. They might well be in love. Their lips part. They move on, their feet inching together across the floor. Joel swallows. He watches them for a little longer, then turns to his parents, his eyes wide. "Do you think they're lesbians?" We're back in the UK with a young Joel and Mr. and Mrs. Black. Joel is now 14, hair longer, growing into himself. His parents do not seem to have changed much. They're sitting at the breakfast table, BBC Radio 3 playing in the background. Much of the audience will recognise Elgar's Variation No. 9, Adagio, Nimrod, as it's more popularly known. Unusual, some might think, for Radio 3 to be playing something so familiar. Ominous, think others who know how movies work. Mr. Black is reading the Times. He's not hiding behind the paper. It's folded in the middle, propped against the teapot, which is covered in a woolen cosy, so he's nominally open to discussion, yet there's clearly no discussion taking place. Mr. Black is in a white shirt and plain blue tie. Joel and his mother are eating breakfast in silence. Joel is wearing a school uniform. Mrs. Black is wearing a pale pink blouse beneath a lurid floral apron. There's a noise at the front door, the sound of letters being pushed through the letterbox. Joel ignores it. Mrs. Black looks at her husband, but he does not lift his eyes from the paper. He's reading the business section. With a resigned expression, Mrs. Black rises from the table and walks down the short corridor to the front door. By the time she gets there, the postman is already out of sight. She bends, lifts the two letters and takes them back through to the kitchen. "Looks like you've both got letters from Jane," she says. Joel looks up, his face instantly brightening, and takes the outstretched letter. Mr. Black might as well not have been spoken to. She gives him a couple of seconds, though she really ought to know better than to expect him to pay her much attention, and then places the letter beside his cup of tea. Joel cleans his butter knife off with a napkin, then slits open the envelope. If Mrs. Black feels left out not receiving a letter, there's no sign of it. She lifts another piece of toast and starts to spread butter over it. Her head turns slightly as though paying attention to the radio. Suddenly Joel pushes his chair back. He doesn't look at his parents. He has the letter in his hand as he leaves the table, but he quickly crushes it and tosses it onto the floor. By the time he's at the door of the kitchen, he's already running. "What on earth?" says Mrs. Black. She half gets out of her seat, but says she's not entirely sure what she'll do when she gets up. And greeted by a glare from Mr. Black, even though he's not actually glaring at her, she sits back down again. Mr. Black has an air of self-importance about him as he finally lays down the vital task of being the Times reader in the family. He lifts the letter, studies it for the moment as though he'll be able to discern the contents just by looking at it. Then he wipes his knife on a napkin, same as his son, and slips open the envelope. He reads the letter, his face expressionless, beneath the watchful gaze of Mrs. Black. In the background, Nimrod soars beautifully towards its conclusion. "Jane's in hospital in New Zealand," says Mr. Black. "Cancer, not expected to see Easter. That girl could have phoned, for goodness sake. Joel, come back here and finish your breakfast!" Mrs. Black is not one for overt displays of emotion, so there's no hand to the mouth in shock. There's no gasp. There's barely a furrowed brow. She looks at her husband for the moment and then lowers her eyes. Perhaps she's not actually that bothered by Jane's illness. She does, however, think about her son, as she knows how much he'll be affected by it. "Joel!" shouts Mr. Black again. It's a bleak day in March, a classic graveside scene. A few mourners, one or two still arriving. Nevertheless, a sparse crowd. Joel is there with his parents and a few other family members. Perhaps there are a couple of people there who we recognise from the wedding a few years earlier, but we know we won't find out who they are. There's a vicar standing across the grave from the Blacks, chatting to another couple of mourners. About 10 yards away, there are two council workers, both of whom are standing with their hands clasped in front of them, heads down, as though the short graveside service is already underway. It's just their way, something they've fallen into, as they wait for the service to begin and quickly conclude. The head of the grave, standing in her own, is Beth. She's now barely 20 and looks young and forlorn and cold too, in a black dress with no coat. No one is paying her any attention except Joel, who's watching her from his position in between his parents. Beth is not crying, but she looks unbearably sad. We understand that she is something of a pariah. No one in the family was likely to have approved of the relationship, though she can hardly be blamed for Jane's cancer. There are some there, Mr. Black included, who believe that if not for Beth, Jane might have come home when her diagnosis had been made. If she'd been treated in Britain rather than New Zealand, wasn't it entirely possible she'd still be alive? "Why is no one standing with Aunt Beth?" asks Joel, his voice low. The question is not directed at either of his parents in particular. In fact, might not be directed to his parents at all. "She looks so lonely." "Just wants to be in her own," says Mrs. Black. As the vicar detaches himself from his graveside conversation, preparing to begin the short service, Joel leaves his parents and walks quickly over to be beside Beth. Mr. Black makes a late grab at his shoulder as he passes just out of his reach, cursing silently at the boy as his fingers brush the back of Joel's coat. Joel stands beside Beth as the vicar clears his throat, finding the appropriate page in the Bible. Joel did not look at her as he walked over, and neither does he do so now. For her part, Beth cannot look at Joel. She cannot look at the lone face of kindness in this awful moment. Joel and Beth are currently about the same height. Their hands hang side by side. Joel hesitates for a moment, and then his fingers tentatively reach for Beth's cold hand. There's no immediate reaction from her, and so Joel boldly takes her hand in his. It's the first instinctive, compassionate act of his life. Beth squeezes his hand in response, but that's all she can do. She cannot speak. She cannot look at him. This is the only comfort she's received since Jane's death. "Thank you, everyone, for coming today," says the vicar, whose voice is strong, as though he's used to addressing much larger outdoor crowds, as we remember Jane Black and the life of a true adventurer.